And you're
Don't
sticking
be a
to it.
Mr. Chair. I'm not in charge, but
we're on. Ready to go?
Yeah.
Yes.
You're blue. We're good?
We're rolling.
All righty. Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it's May 17, 2017. Okay, Patrick tells me we're going to start out with doing a public hearing on House Bill 3101. So we're open on that. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3101 prohibits hotel, inn, or travel entry company from charging a facility fee unless the fee is disclosed at the time that the guest reserves or rents the room, whichever is sooner. This measure has no fiscal or revenue impact. There's no amendments. The House vote was 56-0. Mr. Chair.
Representative, welcome again.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's so nice to be back before you today. For your record, I am still David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast, and I'm pleased to be here today on House Bill 3101, which is a relatively simple bill intended to make life just a little bit easier for tourism consumers here in Oregon, as well as for the tourism industry as a whole. And we would do that by asking them not to charge mandatory surprise fees, which I think are a detriment both to the consumer and also to those institutions that may not be charging such a fee. So here's what we're talking about. The session has ended, and you decide to get away for a couple of days, and maybe you go online and start comparing a couple of good properties, or maybe you're old school like me, and you get on the telephone, and you look at a couple of places to run away to and find out that one of them is $200 and the other one's $240, and all things seem equal, so you go for the lower price property. And you go there, and when you're ready to check out, you find out that they have added a mandatory fee on top of the hotel charge. Now, not all facilities do this. In fact, not even most of them do. Very few do this. And I would argue that when you get these surprise fees, these mandatory fees, that a couple of things happen. One of them is that it leaves an awkward taste in the mouth of the consumer. And the second thing that happens is that those resorts, those lodges, those motels that do not charge such a fee find themselves at a competitive disadvantage because their prices are in fact lower, their prices are lower, but it doesn't look that way because somebody's advertising a lower price and then adding a fee on top of it. Mr. Chairman, I need to make it very clear. I'm not talking about special fees for special services. If you want to bring a dog and there's an extra charge, I've got no problem with that. If you want to have a parking fee in a downtown hotel, I've got no problem with that. I'm talking about things that are most commonly referred to as resort fees. And it works like this. My wife and I got away recently. I had a lovely weekend. When it was time to check out, I was told that the price was increased by $40 a day. And I said, what's that for? And they said, well, that's for the use of the pool and for the tennis court and the jacuzzi. And I said, it's February. And I said, and if this is an additional fee, how come you're charging me a room tax applied to the fee as well as to the room? Well, that's what the Oregon law says you have to do on mandatory fees. And I said, well, it's a resort fee, and it's February, and I just don't see it as being very applicable. And the person at the desk said, well, Mr. Gomberg, you probably should have used the exercise room then. That's included in the resort fee as well.
That was kind of rude.
I took it as Mr. Chairman, Senator
Might
Thompson,
have had a good
I took
point,
it as constructive.
Yeah.
So what we have simply said in this bill is you can't charge mandatory fees unless you tell people in advance that you're doing it. A simple measure, but again, I want to say that I think that it lets consumers compare apples and apples, and it doesn't place people that aren't charging these mandatory fees at a disadvantage in the marketing process.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you said you have no problem with some other fees, but they should also be spelled out in advance as well. A parking fee should be spelled out right away. I mean, that shouldn't be a hidden fee either.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Riley, I agree with you. I think that it would be appropriate to spell out
every fee.
all kinds of fees in advance. But when this bill started out, we were trying to particularly address the mandatory fees that the consumer had no control whatsoever of.
So Representative, I'm trying to figure this one out in my mind, thinking that if you go on to hotels.com or Trivago, if they don't include that fee, and maybe they have a contract with, you know, the Embarcadero in your district, and the Embarcadero says, okay, here's our fees that we're going to have, but they turn it around, and all of a sudden, they're unbeknownst to them, Hotels.com is just advertising the room price. Are they precluded then from charging the resort fee?
Mr. Chairman, I would say yes. If the promotional materials that are available to the public don't specify that what the total mandatory cost is, then those additional fees would not be able to be applied to the bill at when you're ready to check out.
I've heard that we would be the only state with this requirement. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that question. If we are, I think it's a good trend to correct.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
So I get this straight. This doesn't include the normal room tax, transient room tax. Are those already included in the price, or are you're not including those in this? Just that extra charge?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, this bill refers to facility fees, which are distinct from transient lodging taxes. But I would also make sure that it's clear that that facility fees are subject to the transient room tax.
So it's a tax on a fee that you don't need.
Senator?
Yes, I just got a text from my wife, and since she is so very important to me, she goes, "I hate resort fees. You paid $75 per day in Hawaii. It's a ripoff." Therefore, I'm voting yes.
Unfortunately, we can't change the fees in Hawaii.
See how legislation is made in Oregon?
All depends on how your wife wants to vote.
Mr. Chairman, Mrs. Gerard, I appreciate your consideration today.
I would admit it is a surprise. I've encountered the same thing where you're signing up for a room and you get there and you say, "Oh, there's a resort fee."
And Mr. Chairman, it's too late to drive someplace else.
So, particularly if you happen to go over water to get there. All right.
I get it.
Again?
Well, it's like, okay, so let's say you go there, and they don't advertise that if you want to use a swimming pool, you're going to pay $15 a day more. So does this apply to that? If you get there and you want to use a swimming pool, and it's your choice to use a swimming pool, but it's extra, how would that work in this bill?
Thank you for your question, Mr. Chairman. Senator Thompson, a quick piece of background. When I introduced this bill, I just simply said you can't charge mandatory fees. And through some discussions, we decided that we would amend the bill to say unless you tell people in advance what those fees are. And that's part of the reason that we had not initially gotten into the whole question of non-mandatory fees, whether it's a pool charge or a parking charge or a pet fee or a babysitting fee or whatever else. We didn't get into that as this bill emerged because it was narrowly focused on the issue of mandatory fees, often referred to as resort fees. I would say that that this bill does not apply to if they charge you extra to use the pool, and I can't speak right now to whether I think that's a good idea or a bad idea, but if they do that, it would not be subject to the bill as currently written.
Right. So they could still advertise at $80 a night and then in the fine print go swimming pool 15, use the weight room 10, blah, 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 as long as they disclose it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, yes.
So, but that prior notification, I mean, what probably happens in most cases, you're probably yours too, is you got there, you signed, either called somebody and got it, or you went online and you got there and they handed you the registration slip which said it had the resort fee on it, which would be giving you prior notice.
Mr. Chairman, the bill language says prior to the reservation or rental.
Prior to the reservation or rental.
Whichever comes first.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's it. That's all I got. Anybody else want to testify? You want to comment? You want to
vote? Yeah. my wife agrees with Gerard's wife.
I didn't know you knew how to text.
Telepathy. You learned that 50 years ago. All right. Well, anybody else want to testify on this one? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. Do we want to open a work session? All right. Open a work session on House Bill 3101.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3101A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Thompson has moved House Bill 3101A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
So, I know my wife would agree, Mr. Chair, so.
Apparently our wives are voting today. Is further discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion?
My wife.
Your wife is opposed?
Yeah, my wife's opposed.
So does that mean you're
no,
opposed?
I'm going to shut up now.
Okie dokie. Looks like House Bill 3101A moves to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
I'll carry.
And the first wife wants to carry the bill. All righty. Now we're back up to, we'll open a public hearing on 2510.
All right, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2510 authorizes commercial tenants to install and use electric vehicle charging stations on premises, declares charging station to be personal property of the tenant unless a different arrangement is negotiated between the tenant and the landlord, declares an emergency effective upon passage. The measure has minimal fiscal and no revenue. We also have a dash 5 amendment, which I believe one of the people signed up is going to speak to.
I think we'll open both of them. It makes sense. So we'll also open on 2511.
Okay, Mr. Chair. That measure is functionally very similar, except it applies to residential tenants using electric charging stations on premises. For that bill, we have a dash A4 amendment. And for the A4 amendment, unlike the A5 for 2510, we have a minimal fiscal impact and a no revenue impact statement. So that measure would be, if the committee chooses to move, that the committee can.
All right. I thought we had a dash
welcome
three
to the representative from Tesla.
We got a brand new one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart, and I represent House District 11, which is the bigger and better part of your Senate district. I'm very pleased to be here today to present these two bills. Let me give you a quick little bit of history on this issue. Electric vehicles are by far the best way for individuals to get around. Cars are much more fun to drive. They accelerate much quicker. They're more comfortable. They're quieter than internal combustion engine cars, and everyone should eventually, and everyone will eventually, be driving them. There is, however, one drawback for electric vehicles, and that is the need to refuel them takes longer than refueling a gasoline-powered car. If you have a way of refueling a plug-in at your residence and or at work, then that problem goes away. Because when you have a level 2 charger, that is a 240-volt or 208-volt charging system, like what you use to run your dryer at home or that are often used in commercial applications, any of the vehicles that are available now can be completely recharged during the time that people are at work or at home overnight. So one of the keys to getting the adoption of electric vehicles going forward into the future is to allow for the charging facilities at work located near work where people park their cars or at home where people park overnight. That's what these two bills are about. If you own your own residence, it's easy. We passed a law a couple of times ago, I think in 13, that allows condominium owners to to install electric vehicle charging equipment at their condominiums and sets up rules during which the homeowners association and the owner of the unit can make agreements about how to do that. These two bills go the next step. They are for renters, for tenants, residential tenants, House Bill 2511, and commercial tenants, mostly business during the daytime type tenants, House Bill 2510. And they follow essentially, they have essentially the same sort of sideboards as the one having to do with condominiums. And that is that the person who wants the charger, that is the person who's going to use it, the tenant, is going to have to pay for it. He's going to have to follow all the rules that are necessary for the building codes, for safety requirements. He's going to have an electrician come and install it. He's going to have to follow all the rules for architectural design so that he doesn't end up with some kind of an eyesore. And if the landlord wants him to, he's going to have to take it out when he leaves. My belief is that that's never going to happen, because once landlords have figured out that these gadgets are actually valuable and that if the tenant ever does leave, somebody else is going to use it, the landlord will not allow him to take it out. That's my expectation. But the result of that is that this will get us much closer to the point at which it's possible for ordinary folks to buy an electric car and expect that they'll be able to charge it conveniently. Once that's done, there are no advantages to the internal combustion engine car. The electric vehicle is more useful in all the possible ways you can think about it. If there's adequate charging on the highway for long trips, we'll get to that in a different bill. But for this purpose, at least, this will cover 90%+ of the driving that ordinary folks do. Now, let me talk a little bit about 2511 specifically. The House passed the engrossed bill. We made some changes, which you can read. I have to thank the electricians for coming forward and suggesting that when it was time to remove this electric vehicle charger, that an electrician ought to do it. I completely agree with that. So the -4 amendment simply adds the word "and remove" to the section where it talks about installation. The charging station must be installed by a person that holds a license. That's the essence of the provision. And we've added the word "and remove." So when it comes time to remove it, the tenant doesn't come along and just cut the wires. It has to be done by the right person. I would also note that it's required that if it does get removed, the premises has to be restored to the conditions and before it was installed. So you can't just leave a mess behind. You have to do it right. My understanding is that those who are interested in this bill with that amendment are happy with it. The other bill, it turns out, is requiring a little bit more effort. It started out very, very similarly, but for commercial tenants, mostly we're talking about workplaces. And we've got the -5 amendment, which I think deals with pretty much all of the issues that the owners and managers association, building owners and managers association, was concerned about. There is, however, one problem with that amendment. And I'll refer you to the second page of the amendment, line 15. By the way, in both bills, the tenant has to pay all the costs: the cost of reviews, cost of permitting, the cost of installation, damages if any, repairs and maintenance, and the cost of electricity that the tenant would use. And this particular, unfortunately, this particular amendment got drafted in a way that won't work. And it says the cost of electricity associated with a charging station is calculated by the landlord based on the increase in the cost of electricity following the installation of the charging station. Well, if you've ever looked at your electric bill, you know that that's not a number you can ever calculate, because electric utilization changes from month to month and day to day based on the weather and a whole variety of other things. So what I'm going to propose in the -6 is that the language after the comma is removed. So it says the cost of electricity associated with the charging station. And let the landlord and the tenant figure out how to do this. Now, why am I bringing these bills? These bills don't require... These bills are not self-executing. They require that a landlord and a tenant have a conversation and that they end up agreeing on what they're going to do. And that in the normal course of things, the tenant pays for the costs and the bills provide a checklist of the things that need to be done in order to do it. I installed an electric vehicle charger in the condominium that my wife and I own in Portland. It took a year to get the condo association up to speed on the kinds of considerations that you had to consider in order to make a decision. These bills essentially replaced that checklist that we had to devise in order to get there. They were perfectly happy to do it, but they had to get through that checklist. So these bills will make it easier for landlords and tenants to get it done. One more thing. Because it's mandatory that the tenant be allowed to do this, assuming he jumps through all these hoops, that will require the landlord, even if he's not interested, to at least have a conversation about the installation. Here's what's going to happen, my prediction. The ones that are cheap, easy to do, the electrical service is close to the parking space, and there's enough capacity on that electrical service, those will get done because there'll be a few hundred dollars to install them using an electrician to do it. The ones that are really expensive, where you're going to have to install new service, where you're going to have to run a long conduit a long way, those are not going to get done, at least not at first, unless somebody like the IOUs come along, the investor-owned utilities or the other utilities come along and say, yeah, we'll help subsidize this because we're going to sell you power and it'll be good for us to do that. Unless they come along and do something like that, I don't think the expensive ones are going to happen because, again, the tenant has to pay for all the costs. Finally, note that the landlord has to sign off on building permits. So until the landlord gets what he wants, he just doesn't sign the building permit. I think this landlord is very completely protected. The tenant then gets a right to have a conversation with the landlord about doing it, and the inexpensive ones will get done. We'll sell more electric cars. We'll buy less gasoline from out of state and will improve the state economy, and it'll be a lot more fun for some people to drive. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Thompson?
Yeah. What did it cost you to put in your charging station at your condo?
Oh, you don't want me to get into that story.
Did you have to run the condo?
In the condo, the condo, there are three deeds.
Okay.
One for the condo, one for a storage space, and one for the parking space. So we own the parking space.
Okay.
In order to get the line installed, we first had to find out that there was, in fact, capacity on the house lights panel in the condominium. We can't get to my panel because my panel is on the 10th floor.
Wow.
So that doesn't work. So the house lights panel is in the electrical room in the garage.
Okay.
So there's space there. So what we ended up doing was we installed a submeter coming off of that panel and a conduit that ran along the ceiling, mm-hmm. 200 and some odd feet, down to a plug-in on the pillar next to my parking space. And I use the charging cable that comes with my car to plug into that, looks like a dryer plug,
okay.
is what it amounts to. The total cost of the thing, if I remember correctly, was about $3,800. And we used the electrician that had built the building.
Okay.
So they understood the building, and the association was comfortable
right.
with having that electrician build it. Now, I'm not going to tell you who it was because I'm going to tell you the rest of the story. It turned out that the cable, the wire that they installed, was too small, and it got hot as a result of that. They had to come in, take the entire conduit down, put in a larger conduit with bigger wire so that it would not get hot, and they learned something. The building code is different for an electric vehicle station where the charge is going to happen for several hours at a time than it is for a dryer that's going to run heat for 10 minutes at a time and then go back to tumbling and then come back on again later.
Right.
So they learned an important lesson. But because it was the electrician chosen by the homeowners association, I never got any feedback on that. And the electrician ate it. He paid for the second installation himself. He knew he'd made a mistake. So it does require an expert, and I'm glad the IBEW representative sitting in the back so he can warn his members to be sure to look at the specs before they install the cabling.
Go ahead. So is there anything in the bill or in the agreement? Do you see, because let's say you live in an apartment and you got community parking spots.
Right.
So you pay all this money to put in your meter. How do you guarantee that I don't pull in right in front of you and take your spot?
Right.
You're probably going to be a little mad about that.
Right. That
will
would
there
be
an agreement with you and the...
That would be something. That would be subject to agreement between you and the landlord about how to manage that.
Yep.
I mean, the landlord is protected because the landlord doesn't have to let you have any particular space you want.
Right.
They can force you to take the space in the back corner that nobody else wants. If that's what they want to do, and they can, and then at that point you put a sign on it, or you say it's assigned to apartment number so and so, or something like that, to deal with that issue. But that would be one of those things that
work out with
you'd have to work out. And that's the reason why I say what this really is a checklist and a license to have a conversation. That's what it really amounts to, even though it's written as if it's mandatory. Because there's a number of things in any particular installation that you're going to have to shake hands on in order to get it done.
Other questions of the representative? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I should ask you if you got some work.
Oh, the 11's ready with the dash 4.
Well, we just well do them at the same time.
The 10 needs some more work, as I indicated.
So if we hold them over to the 24th, 25. Is that enough time for you to get it done?
The 20.
That's a week from today.
Today.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
All righty. And I have Drew Hagedorn and Brian Craig on a different bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Drew Hagedorn appearing today on behalf of NAIOP, the Commercial Real Estate Developers Industry Association. I'm pinch hitting for Nellie DeVries, who represents the Building Owners and Managers Association. We want to thank Representative Barnhart, Mr. Brennan, Mr. Dale, and Legislative Council for working with us on amendments. We're comfortable with the verbiage in the dash fives. I did speak with Representative Barnhart about some work to perfect the language in the dash five that he alluded to in his testimony. So we'll work with him on that. I think his solution probably will work for our clients, so we'll be comfortable with dash sixes that I expect to be forthcoming. So thank you very much.
Okay. Brian?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm here today representing the Oregon State Association of Electrical Workers. That's all 7 IBEWs in Oregon. And I'll speak to both bills if I can. And the
Brian, you gotta put your name on the record.
Oh, Brian Krieg, sorry. We will be in support of both of the bills. We're very pleased about the work that the representative did about putting in safeguards about using licensed electricians to do the installations and certified equipment being used. And also then in the differing all the amendments that are being composed, there is the issue about also that the removal of the system if somebody did want to take it out. I would note that just remind us that electricity is a safety issue, in particular when we're moving up into the 208 volt type electricity you're going to be using on the charge or the phase two type of chargers, very deadly. So we want to make sure everyone stays safe.
Great. Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on either of these bills? Seeing none, I think we're going to carry House Bill 2010 and 2511 over till May 24th, and we'll close the public hearing on those. And we want to go down here to House Bill, open a public hearing on House Bill 3139A. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3139A adds museum-related activities to the definition of arts, requires Oregon Business Development Department Director when determining grant eligibility under the arts program to take into consideration regional differences in arts and cultural development, as well as promote investment in communities where engagement in arts and cultural development is limited. We have a dash A3 amendment, Mr. Chair, that transfers duties for taking into account regional differences in program from the Director of Oregon Business Development Department to the Oregon Arts Commission, and directs the commission to suggest rules to the Director for Grant Programs as minimal fiscal and no impact with the dash A3 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Representative.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Beyer. Esteemed members of the committee, for the record, my name is Representative Newt Buehler. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend, and bringing to you House Bill 3139, passed with overwhelming bipartisan bipartisan support, and it's at the request of the High Desert Museum, who's not in my district, but very close and intimately involved in the Bend community. Here's some background. The Oregon Arts Commission recently changed its eligibility criteria for its operating grants program and also another program called the Arts Learning Program. And in doing so, they determined that arts institutions like the High Desert Museum are no longer eligible for funding. As you can imagine, this caused some difficulties. In making this change, I believe that the commission really strayed from the original intention of actually a Senate bill back in 1967. And that time, legislators' intention, at least by my review, was to really spread arts throughout the state, have it flourish, and do it based not on the type of art, but rather on the quality of the art, which I think is important. So this bill, in my opinion, seeks to restore the status quo and return to the original legislative intent by promoting the quality of the art throughout the entire state. So the bill amends the statutory definition of arts to basically clarify that museum-related activities are included within the definition, and this amendment is aligned with definitions used by the National Endowment for the Arts. So I'd greatly appreciate your support of the concept in House Bill 3139.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Dana Whitelaw, and I'm the Executive Director of the High Desert Museum. I'm testifying in support of House Bill 3139. The purpose of the bill is to clarify the existing statutory language, ensuring equitable support for high-quality arts and cultural programming. First, the bill clarifies that the statutory definition of arts includes museum-related activities, such as exhibitions, collections care, educational programs. That provision makes express that museum activities use art in various forms to interpret our culture and sense of place, and that the legislature always intended to support these activities. Importantly, including museum activities in this definition aligns with the work that is supported by the National Endowment for the Arts. Aligning Oregon's statutory definition with the NEA is undeniably good public policy. Second, the new language instructs the arts program to suggest rules for grants, which take into account the regional differences throughout the state. Those rules should ensure that the eligibility criteria for grant awards is transparent, objective, and equitable in addressing public access to arts and culture where opportunities are limited. The funding strategies should reflect the variation that we see in access to arts experiences. Most fundamentally, I believe this bill restores the original intent of the 1967 legislation, Senate Bill 145. At that time, legislators articulated that the premise was to encourage the arts to flourish and not to focus on the type of art, but rather the quality. This bill seeks to restore that premise of promoting quality art throughout the state. The High Desert Museum has benefited from operating support and arts learning grants since 2012 until we were deemed ineligible in 2016. For those of us east of the Cascades, the closest dedicated art museum is in Eugene, 130 miles away. Organizations like the High Desert Museum address the need of providing equitable arts and culture experiences across a broad swath of the state without adequate access. For example, the museum has become a leader in STEAM, that's science, technology, engineering, arts, and math education, and we're proud to say that we're one of four organizations in the nation to receive a prestigious STEAM grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services. This project is examining the best ways to partner with libraries and provide rural families with STEAM experiences. This is a two-year, $250,000 grant. In the last 9 years, I've seen multiple arts organizations fold under the funding challenges in our region. These organizations include the Cascade Festival of Music, the Nature of Words Literary Festival, and Arts Central, the Arts Learning Center in Bend. Central Oregon is booming economically, but our arts organizations are not. After determining that the museum was not eligible for operating grants or arts learning, the Oregon Arts Commission did not award any arts learning grants in Central Oregon last year. Why? No one else applied, and the High Desert Museum was ineligible. With House Bill 3139, the legislature has the opportunity to distribute its limited grant funding equitably throughout the state. Arts and culture anchors, like the High Desert Museum, provide arts experiences that are simply not available otherwise in many parts of Oregon. We have over 7,000 Native American art objects in our collection, a significant Western art collection, permanent exhibitions of sculptures. We offer museum-quality experiences and a lens through which to explore our world more deeply. It is our job to train the eyes of our youngest Oregonians to see things in a new light, add inspiration, awe, and aesthetic beauty. Organizations like the High Desert Museum need to be eligible for these programs through the Arts Commission to enhance the quality of life for all Oregonians through the arts. I will close with a quick story. In Central Oregon, our reach is extensive and inclusive. The museum welcomes over 170,000 visitors and 12,000 students a year. And just last month, we welcomed all the Head Start families in Central Oregon. For most of these families, they've never visited us before. We expected 400, and over 800 came through our doors. Through this program, we provide each Head Start family with a membership so they can enjoy the museum all year, and a gas card for every trip they make to the museum, so we remove that barrier of transportation cost. With this, we've given these families their first museum experiences. I walked through the exhibitions that evening and saw pure joy, inspiration, and awe on the faces of not only these preschoolers, but the rest of their families as well. Those many extended families now have access to this cultural treasure in our state. Few of these families have the means and therefore the habit of visiting places like the Portland Art Museum or making it to Eugene. Let's ensure that arts and culture organizations in rural areas of Oregon can provide quality arts experiences for Oregonians, and House Bill 3139 helps us get there. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Monroe?
Would this legislation also have an impact on the Warm Springs Museum?
They are still eligible for the operating grants through the Arts Commission. But for example, it could help the two organizations work together on an arts learning program that we would be able to apply for and work with the Warm Springs Museum on those types of projects. So I'll say yes, it would help them.
Well, it's interesting that the Warm Springs Museum is eligible and the High Desert is not, because, you know, both of you do a wonderful job of portraying Indian artifacts and so on and culture. It's a bit shocking to me that High Desert Museum, which I have visited many times, would be excluded. I'm happy to support this legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, John Frommeyer and Brian Rogers. Welcome.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Rogers, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Arts Commission and the Cultural Trust. I'm here to testify on the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 3139A, and the A3 amendments are a technical fix that transfers the responsibility for taking into account regional differences in program from the Director of Oregon Business Development Department to the Oregon Arts Commission, and directs the Commission to suggest rules to the Director for grant programs. This is in line with current writing authority and agency statute. Senate Bill 3139 codifies the Arts Commission's ability to offer grant programs and services in all regions of Oregon. Equitable geographic reach is a primary concern for the Arts Commission. The Arts Commission staff and commissioners will develop recommendations concerning regional differences and, as needed, seek public input, as we did during our strategic planning process. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Frommeyer. Just a brief resume, I was chairman of the committee that selected arts for this building, and in fact, the Judy Foxton, Foxton Fox weaving behind you is sort of an old friend. That was in 1975. I was subsequently appointed to the Oregon Arts Commission by both Governors Atiyah and Straub, served as 4 years chair there, was appointed by the first President Bush as chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, served during that administration, and then on returning to Oregon, have been on the Oregon Humanities Board and chaired that board as well. And I tell you this not to toot my own horn, but just to say that over the last 40-some years, I have been heavily invested in the culture of Oregon, and I am most proud of it. The changes in this bill are not significant in the sense that they do a lot of changing, but they do clarify that museums are eligible. And it's sometimes deemed as a fool's errand to try to define art. But I think anybody who engaged in that would include museums, because museums, in fact, are the repository of what we most treasure. And they are selected with great – the items in them are selected with great care, and they show us who we are. So to include that is not only consistent with what the National Endowment for the Arts has done since its inception, but to make sure that Oregon doesn't shortchange museums. And one of the things about this, and this is consistent with the other part of the bill, which extends it to areas and asks essentially for equity, many of the arts organizations in rural parts of Oregon do a lot of things. They do things that are historical. They do things that are basically in the aspect of some libraries, and they act as museums. So, what the bill is really doing is saying you're not going to be able to compare what happens in the highest areas of urban arts with what happens in the areas that are not urban. And it's hopeful that the Oregon Arts Commission, the National Endowment for the Arts for sure, serves all Americans no matter where they are and makes arts accessible. And I'll have to say that since 1965, when the two endowments were passed by Congress, you would be hard-pressed to find a more successful program. And it's not that we have been without controversy. Yes. I know that pretty well. But it is a program that has, I think, succeeded well beyond anyone's imagination in bringing the arts to all Americans and really glorifying and celebrating the arts in a way that I think is quite extraordinary. So I would welcome your questions or anything else, but I have to say that this is a bill that should pass.
I really appreciate you taking the time to come in, and I do know that you have quite a bit of experience talking about what is and what isn't art and what's quality art and what's not. Yes.
Yeah. Well, as you do, Mr. Chairman, because I know that you had a very helpful hand in the cultural trust, and that's most appreciated. And Senator Girard, I am one of your constituents. I hail from the metropolis of Jefferson.
Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment. As someone who grew up on a farm and was an art major in college, I really appreciate the fact that we want to protect the art in rural areas. I think that's very important. So I appreciate this bill.
Yeah. Anybody else? Seeing it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3139? Seeing none, we will close public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3139A.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3139A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator has moved 3139A.
Oh, no, Mr. Chair, we do have
an amendment.
Oh, we got to do the amendment. Take that back.
I take it back.
We've got to do the amendment.
What's the number?
A3, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Dash
Chairman,
you've got to be quicker on that.
I know. I'm a little
we're a little rusty today.
Mr. Chairman, I move the -3 amendment to House Bill 3139A.
Senator Thompson now has moved the dash A3 amendments to House Bill 3139A. Is there any discussion on that? The amendment is adopted. Go one
okay,
more time.
Now we'll do. We'll move. I move House Bill 3139 with the dash three A with the A3. Dash three amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson has moved House Bill 3139A as amended by the dash A3 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? The motion passes by unanimous vote, and would the art major like to carry it?
Sure, absolutely.
All right. Senator Riley will carry. We'll close on that.
Mm-hmm.
Bottom of the list.
About 26,
all right, 22. So we will now open a public hearing on House Bill 3184A. So we've done this one, this one, this one, this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3184 authorized the Department of Consumer Business Services to develop and implement a payday title loan tracking system that includes loan counseling component for consumers. Purpose: payday loan and title loan licensees from charging consumer any amount to recover costs. Licensees pay to access that tracking system. Becomes operative on July 1st, 2018. Declares an emergency effective upon passage. It has minimal fiscal, no revenue impact. There's no amendments. And the House vote on this, Mr. Chair, was 50-6.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Alonso Leon, and I represent District 22, which covers Woodburn through the north part of Salem. House Bill 3184 makes two small changes to how our state is able to track and regulate the predatory practice of payday and title lending. Before I go into the specifics, I want to acknowledge the work that members of this committee have done to ensure that Oregon consumers are protected from some of the worst practices of these predatory lenders over the last 10 years, making sure that low-income people who are pressed for money don't find themselves trapped in bad deals. Capping interest rates and limiting rollovers on these loans has helped ensure that consumers can take out loans with interest rates in the hundreds that roll over for months and months, ballooning into considerably large amounts of debt. These regulations are essential to helping protect our consumers. What I now see as a next step is increasing the financial literacy of Oregon consumers so that they are able to make informed financial decisions. I strongly believe that education is a necessary component to a thriving economy where consumers make the best decisions for themselves. My vision for the next steps in combating these predatory lending practices is establishing a loan counseling program for borrowers to take before taking out a payday or title loan to ensure that there is a base level of understanding of what the terms are of the loan. Even with Oregon's substantial regulations surrounding the payday and title lending market, many of our constituents are still paying extraordinary amount in fees. The Center for Responsible Lending estimates that over $16 million in fees are paid out by Oregonians every single year on payday and title loans. These loans are designed to attract people who are in significant financial trouble and are disguised as simple, inexpensive, and easy to pay back. Educating these consumers about the fees and costs of payday loans, as well as teaching them about basic financial literacy, empowers them to make the best choice for their financial situation. These predatory loans are continuing to trap people into worsening debt. It is estimated by the Center for Responsible Lending that an average person with a payday loan in Oregon has taken out four different payday loans, and tens of thousands of consumers have six or more loans. House Bill 3184 lays the groundwork for that vision while helping our state enforce the regulations that we have already passed. In existing statute, DCBS has the authority to contract with a vendor to develop and implement a system to track these loans and verify whether the loan meets state regulations around payday and title lending. We have been in communication with a vendor that operates a payday and title lending database in 14 other states, including Washington, to learn about how their system helps them regulate the lending market. One vendor that we have been in communication with integrates their database into the software used at the point of sale by lenders. This means that there can be an instant verification that the loan issued meets state regulations. This particular vendor does not charge the state any fees for the use of their database, and instead charges the lender a small fee for every loan issued. The existing fees and states that operate such a database range from 30 cents to $1.50 per loan. The change that House Bill 3184 makes to our statute is to clarify that any fee charged by a vendor to the lender cannot be passed through to the consumer. HB 3184 also requires that any vendor that DCBS contracts with to implement a loan tracking system must also be capable of hosting and tracking the completion of a financial literacy or loan counseling program through the rulemaking process. We can then have the longer conversation of how to structure a loan counseling program, how to provide access to it, and when or whether it should be required. If this bill is passed, I would look forward to working together during the interim with stakeholders in the financial literacy and lending communities to build a system that helps boost Oregon's financial literacy rates among the populations that need it most, those who are targets of predatory loans. With these changes, DCBS can move forward with rulemaking followed by a competitive bid process to contract with a vendor so that we can create a more robust enforcement system for payday and title loans. This not only helps us enforce the laws and regulations that we already have, but it allows us to have considerably more data regarding payday and title loans in our state. Instead of relying on self-reported data from lenders, we will have access to real-time information as well as a way of enforcing our rollover limit at point of sale. I ask for your support on this bill so that we can continue the work that has been done in the state to protect our consumers from predatory loans and begin conversations about financial literacy and lending. Rick Blackwell from DCBS right next to me is here to answer any questions you may have in regards to details surrounding the loan database. So you can also, and you can also see written testimony submitted by credit unions regarding the importance of financial literacy regarding lending. Thank you so much for your time, committee.
Thank you.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, policy manager with DFR, so the Division of Financial Regulation. So we would be responsible, my unit would be responsible for writing the rules, and my colleagues would be doing the competitive bidding process. I really am here for questions.
Well, I got some, because I frankly am having trouble understanding this.
Right.
How it would work. So this says the department may, and say have to, hire a contractor to do these things, which are provide counseling. So you'd be providing counseling to potential title loan borrowers? Is that the idea?
Chair Byer, that's I'll defer to you.
Yeah, so the idea is to really increase education around basically increase financial literacy among folks who are thinking about getting a loan from title loan companies and such.
So how would people know that that service was available if the department made it available?
Chair Byer, members of the committee, so the system would actually essentially, from the demonstrations that I've seen, would essentially flag that this person would receive counseling of some manner, which the manner and the process of which we'll want to set by rule in consultation with stakeholders.
I'm still lost.
Chair Byer, so we want to create a basically financial counseling system.
I get that part.
Okay. In order for us to create the curriculum and the process, that would be worked through the rules process, but we would need to have a data system to use and to help us develop the curriculum. And eventually, what we want to do is provide this information, to answer your question, Chair, is be able to have it in places where they can take this basically like a mini workshop, whether it's online, and be able to get the training to help them have the financial counseling so they can increase their financial literacy before having access to these title loan companies. So it could be online, and we're looking at making sure that they are in multiple languages.
So how does DCBS pay for this vendor that they would contract with?
Chair Beyer, the contract would actually specify that the licensee, the folks that are going to be making the payday or title loan will be the ones that are paying for the system. That's how in my understanding, that's how it typically works in other states. We actually requested that consumers don't have this as a pass-on or a tacked-on fee, because as it is, the effective 36% APR is actually higher given fees.
Very
and charges.
High. It's a very expensive loan.
Yeah,
we've dealt with that before.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, we yeah. have. You want to try?
Yes. So let me walk through this and tell me where I'm wrong.
Okay.
What you want to do is you want to install a system at loan institutions that would track loan applications and with the database, so that we would have, when someone applies for a loan, we'd know about it. We'd know that they either have or have not already had the training, because it's in the database. And if they have not had it, they'd be required to get it before they take out the loan, and the loan institution would be paying for the system. Now, my question, and let me finish that, and then you can tell me. My question is that all loan institutions in the state, or are we going to, or is it only going to be the high interest institutions?
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley. So the idea is that right now we would only be tracking data on people who apply for title loans and what was the other one?
Payday loans.
Yes.
So 36% interest loans.
Correct. We want to make sure that we track that, so we have a data system in place mm-hmm. to track who's applying for those type of loans. As per as per my presentation, a lot of folks are getting multiple loans to try to cover the loan they just, got, because they only have 60 days to pay for it, and oftentimes they don't have enough money to pay it back, so they get themselves in worse financial situation. And so the idea is then that we would have this data system to be able to give us data and information on creating a career basically a credit counseling program, and we would work through the rules process to create a curriculum.
Yeah, I got all that. But was I correct in that the system that you install would know whether or not the applicant had already taken the class?
The idea is that, yes, the idea
yes,
is that
that's
the system,
all I need to know.
Yeah,
yes.
The system will be able to acknowledge whether they have a certificate,
got
they pass it or not, yes.
Okay.
Senator Thompson?
So you want to develop a system that adds, some more stuff to these businesses, but you don't want to let them pass that cost on? I mean, to me, if we're a government, we're putting a regulation on a business, and then we're telling them they can't recoup their costs, then really the state should pay for that. If this is something that we're saying is good for Oregonians, but you can't recover your costs for it, then I think it should come from the state. I think we should pay for that. So you're saying that the business can't recoup their costs for this, and do they have to do it? Or is it a May? Is this a requirement of these folks? We're going to make it mandatory, or is this they can do it if they want?
I understand.
Chair Beyer and Vice Chair Thompson. So the database, it's permissive for us to contract with and deploy the database. Once the database is in place, then it will really depend on whether the standards that we set for the loan counseling is mandatory for all borrowers, or if we work through that with stakeholders, figure out, is there a way to, at least on a pilot basis or some other way, deliver the training first, and then figure out later if whether this needs to be mandatory or not. But the system is, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. If this is mandatory, I'll probably oppose it. If it's not mandatory, unless we allow them to recover the cost of doing this, I'd probably be against it.
So how would you? Are we done?
Yeah, I think.
So it's kind of almost a double negative. It says DCBS may develop a system by means of which a licensee may determine, and there's a whole list of things there. So that's a may. Is that licensee may? Will that be prescriptive when you obtain?
Once you.
So provide loan counseling in accordance with standards. So that's when you adopt rules on loan counseling. That's where you would turn around and make it mandatory. Is that the idea? Is that how you're reading that, Rick?
Mm-hmm. Chair Beyer, yeah, depending. So may can be read differently in different contexts.
Yeah, I'm realizing that. Yeah. That's where I'm going.
maybe it needs some more work.
Well, Chair Beyer.
I think this bill does not make it, to answer your question, this bill does not make it mandatory. But it authorizes the department through administrative rules to make it mandatory.
Correct.
And the question is, really, when you're imposing a cost like any other, the directly and indirectly is problematic in that all business costs are generally passed on in one way or another.
Mr. Chair, I would say, though, that the interest rate, this body has chosen some time ago to set interest rates and fees at a particular level. So,
yes, it's already set.
Which, as I recall, is a maximum cap, right?
36%.
The APR, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Remember, it probably came out of your consumer.
Yes, it did. 36%.
36%.
Which is huge.
Huh?
Which is huge to start with. So these companies, if I may, Mr. Chair, these companies are
big enough fee that
are making plenty of money without worrying about whether they pass this little bitty fee through or not.
So how many are you envisioning? Just one database or multiple, each licensee having a database?
Chair Beyer, the way that this has been working in other states, such as Washington, is that there is one single database that that provides the service to the licensees in the state.
And so are you reading this then? I think I'm following up on Representative Riley's question. You're assuming that when someone applied for a loan, the licensee would have to go into the database and check and see have they had a loan before or a number of loans?
Chair Beyer,
if they hadn't had the counseling, they would have to do the counseling before they could make the loan.
Mm-hmm. Chair Beyer, yes, that is correct. That we want them to do the counseling before they get the loan. And just to reiterate, the fee ranges that we've been told from these type of companies is that they charge anywhere between 30 cents and $1.50 per loan. And again, the fees would go to the company, the title loan companies, not the consumer or the state.
So then, see if I'm understanding that correctly. So if I'm a licensee and you come to me for a loan, before I can make that loan, I've got to go to some vendor of the DCBS to check and see what's going on there, you know, if you've had a loan or had this before. And when I do that, the vendor then will charge me a dollar something for having queried it?
Mr. Chair, from the what I have seen, that integrates into the point of sale applications that the vendors use already. So it would actually, once information is input into the system for loan application, then the system or the vendor that we're describing here acts as a back end, will put up probably some sort of message that, you know, this person needs counseling or the one-time counseling or it is not, or they've already had it and that you can proceed with the rest of the loan transaction.
But the fee, I, as a licensee, I have to pay the vendor for having queried the system. That's just the charge.
Sure, that's correct.
Okay. Yeah. So that's my cost of making the loan, among other things, the dollar and a quarter or dollar and a half, whatever it is. That's what it is. And I'd be required under rules to say, okay, you haven't had it, so I can't make the loan until you go do this online course?
That is correct, Chair Beyer.
What, might that not be an inconvenience to somebody who really needs the money right now?
Chair Beyer, we recognize that could be an issue. I think that it's really important to make sure that people have the education to make those decisions. This is a way to help people understand before they sign up for a loan such as this, because 36% interest rate is still a lot. And before they make that decision, we want to make sure that they have the financial literacy and the information before making that decision.
I don't disagree with you, but to some degree, I'm a little concerned that before someone is in a position where they really want to pay that, they kind of got an idea that what it's going to cost them, that they must really need the money.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
You may.
So thank you. I agree that it could be an inconvenience to some people, but it's a lot less of an inconvenience than to have a loan that you can't pay back and to have to borrow another, get another loan to pay that loan back. That's much more of an inconvenience in my mind.
And Chair Beyer, if I can add to that.
I'm torn.
It's just, I think that it's one of the other things that we, and through the rules process that we've been talking about, is a lot of folks who are in an emergency situation and do want to get a loan in an emergency way. We also want to be able to provide information in part of the training in making sure that they have state resources or know about state resources. Sometimes simply people can't pay their mortgage or their rent. And if we identify resources for them, they might be able to go through the training, but understand that there's resources outside of getting a loan such as this that would put them in a bad financial position.
And you understand, Mr. Chair, why the credit unions are in favor of this.
Cut that out. Senator Durant, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I have a little bit of a comment. And first of all, I know 36% is an extremely high interest rate, but remember, these are very high-risk loans. They really truly are. But I see this as an extremely slippery slope, because credit cards are anything but a good deal, too. And so where do you...
Well, those are 36%.
So I think they're high at max out at
18%.
Right? Yeah, something like that, but still nuts. So, I mean, where do you draw the line as to what's nuts and what's not?
Well, we have on payday loans.
Yeah, we did.
We've set a limit on them already.
We set the cap at 36%.
Which I thought was too high at the time.
Senator Monroe?
Yeah, I haven't said anything yet. A few years ago, high schools used to require students to take personal finance.
Mm-hmm. They did.
They don't anymore. And these are the kinds of things, like you're advocating, that were taught in personal finance. I don't know. An awful lot of people just don't know, have a clue as to how to manage money, how to borrow, how to use a credit card. The credit card companies keep sending you more credit cards, and so you use one to pay off the other, and it's kind of the same kind of scam. You end up piling up a huge percentage of debt. I don't know what the answer is to that. I wish there were some way that we could require every adult, before they learn how to walk, learn how to manage money a little better, and I think the whole world would be better off.
I think that's what this does.
That's the idea.
Okay. Any other questions? Are we now thoroughly confused? Or thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Do I have some others? No, I don't have.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to testify? Okay.
This isn't jumping up.
I don't see anybody jumping up, but it's a tough subject. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3184A. Do we want to go to work session?
Where are you?
I'm a yes.
Oh, good. Thanks, guys. All right. We'll open a work session. Senator Monroe, you want to make a motion?
I'll make the motion. I don't have a problem doing that.
What's the number? 3184. I move House Bill 3184A to the floor with a due pass for recommendation.
Okay, Senator Thompson has moved House Bill 3184A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Okay. I'm going to be a no now, and I might change my mind later.
I've known you to do that.
I just thought recently. I would announce it now.
Even if he carries the bill.
So Senator Monroe doesn't get mad at me.
Is anybody else?
I'm just
Senator
Gerard,
are you a no? Mm-hmm. You're a no. You're a yes.
I'm a yes.
Senator Riley's asked, okay, we will pass this bill to the Senate floor, but they do pass recommendations. Senator Riley, you seem to understand it the best. Would you like to carry this?
I'll carry it, yes.
Okay. We're closed on that. And we're moved to open a public hearing on House Bill 2624.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2624 exempts out-of-state banks, institutions, and foreign associations that hold a certificate of authority filed by the Department of Consumer Business Services to conduct banking business from the requirement to file additional notice with and paying a fee to the department prior to dealing in notes secured by mortgages or trust deeds. This measure has no fiscal or revenue impact. There is no amendments, Mr. Chair, and the measure moved out of the House on a vote of 52-5.
Welcome, Mr. Martinez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. I'm joined by longtime counsel Ken Sherman Jr., who has been general counsel for the OBA for about 35 years, I think. So 40 years, excuse me, I'm corrected already. And I would just say thank you for hearing this bill, scheduling this bill. I know you guys don't keep very good records, so I'll freely admit that we made a mistake, but make sure that's not in the minutes or anything. About every 20 years, I think this is Ken's third time, actually, we rewrite the Bank Act and modernize it, bring it up to date. In 2015, you passed that bill. We work with conjunction with DCBS and bank lawyers and others to prepare that legislation. And in going over the act, and the new law, we discovered that we left out a couple of words in a 70-page bill. Shame on us. So we're here to put those words back in. There were no folks testifying in opposition on the House side. I don't know if DCBS is still in the room or not, but I do not believe they object to this bill. So with that, I'll let Mr. Sherman briefly, because you've been inundated today, briefly describe the change we're trying to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Ken Sherman, Jr. I'm general counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association, and Tim has done a pretty good job of giving you the general picture of this bill. Basically, we're talking here about out-of-state institutions and foreign associations and extranational institutions. Those are all defined terms in the Bank Act, which is Chapter 706 through 716. And in Oregon, if you are one of those types of institutions, in other words, you're not an Oregon bank, and you're going to want to come in and do some banking services in Oregon, there are basically a couple of ways you can do that. One is to go the full bore and file an application with DCBS and get approved to do a full line of banking services in the state. The other way, and this is done a lot of times by institutions that don't want to come in here and, like, take deposits and set up trust companies and that sort of thing, all they really want to do is make loans, and they establish what we call loan production offices typically. And so in Chapter 713 of the Bank Act, there's kind of two tracks. As I say, you can go the full bore application, or you can go the much shorter way to get approved just to make loans. What this bill would do is correct an oversight in the earlier legislation so that a bank that has one of these extranational institutions that has gone through the full bore application process, and then they want to make loans, they don't have to go through this separate process because they've already been approved for everything they could do. So that's really all the bill has to do, and you have my written testimony in front of you, and
very
so
clear.
I'll be happy to answer questions.
Unlike the last one, this one seems pretty clear.
Yeah,
this is a good bill.
Questions of the speakers, the panel. Anybody got a question? I don't see any.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
Thank you very much. Okay. Anybody else wish to address this bill? Seeing none, we'll close public hearing. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2624.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2624 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Aaron Thompson's moved House Bill 2624 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, House Bill 2624 moves to the Senate floor. They do pass. And before I do this, Riley, I gave you two bills to carry. Would you rather not carry one?
No, I'm fine.
You're good? Okay. Well, I will carry 2624 then.
Okay.
You had to carry three today. And I think that takes us to the end.
Yes,
you're done.